From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
The fallout from the coronavirus and the government's ban on non-Australians coming from China is having a devastating effect on Australian universities, which are highly dependent on Chinese students. Some 100,000 of these students have not yet been able to take up or resume their studies for this year. Universities have been scrambling to make alternative arrangements for them, including through online courses, but there are all sorts of difficulties. The government is currently looking at how to mitigate some of the damage to the sector. Today we're joined by Phil Honeywood to talk about the implications of the crisis for what is one of Australia's top export industries, tertiary education. Phil Honeywood is the CEO of the International Education Association of Australia, as well as chair of the federal government's Global Reputation Task Force, which is the body responsible for advising the government on how best to assist the education sector post-coronavirus. Phil Honeywood, due to the travel bans, nationally more than 100,000 Chinese tertiary students have either missed the start of the academic year or are likely to miss it. As we speak, we don't know how long this ban will be in place, but what are the best and the worst case scenarios for these students as well as their institutions?
The best case scenario would clearly be for the current travel ban imposed by the federal government to be lifted this Friday, which of course would be the 1 week additional period which the Prime Minister announced coming on top of the initial 2 week travel ban. But of course, in all of this, whilst that would be a best case scenario, we have to remind ourselves that the Chinese themselves have banned the taking of English language tests in China because of concerns about bringing large groups of people together. So commencing students in some cases have missed the boat on their English language tests, which they would be taking with different English language testing companies such as IELTS in China itself. We've also now got a situation in which many airlines have dropped their flights out of China, and those that still have flights are allegedly charging exorbitant fares to leave China. And we've got the additional challenge of accommodation, where we've got an incredible booming industry here in Australia now of purpose-built student accommodation companies, in most cases owned by British or Canadian pension funds. And they, of course, are worried about, given their reliance on the China market, and they're now looking at, in many cases, filling up their rooms with domestic and non-Chinese students at different price points. So there's quite a few domino effects if the students don't get to come here within the next 2 week period.
And what happens if the ban goes on for a while?
Obviously, if the ban continues past the April the 4th census date, which most universities have to apply, then that will mean that effectively the students have missed first semester. Now, I mean, our principal concern is with students' welfare, and of course, that's why many institutions are scrambling to come up with online learning solutions, if not to be able to provide the students with meaningful academic progress or academic credit in some cases, to try and keep the students engaged, interested. I mean, you've got over 100,000 offshore Chinese students who in many cases are sitting at home in apartments, not knowing what to do with themselves because they can't really go out and party with friends. And of course, they're meant to be doing study and they've got parents who have invested a lot of money in their study program. So the parents are keen to see their children studying and continue the engagement with their enrolled education institution.
We'll come back to some of that in a minute, but let's just talk about secondary students, because we don't hear so much about them, but there are quite a few Chinese secondary school students studying in Australia, or meant to be studying in Australia, aren't there? What do you know about those?
Happily, most of our Chinese students who were enrolled in public and private schools across Australia were in fact able to travel here in time, and those that missed the start of the school year, mainly because they had to go into self-quarantine for 14 days. Because our school year starts 2 months before or thereabouts our university academic year, in many cases the Chinese students had arrived. I know of some schools that are having special welcome back parties for their students who have been in self-quarantine, and so those that were in that situation were also provided, in most cases, by their schools with homework and study to do at home while they're in the 14-day quarantine period. So it's been a happier story for the high schools, all the information suggests. Of course, keep in mind that of the 720,000 full fee-paying international students in Australia, only 3% are actually in our government and private high schools. But of that 3%, more than half are from China. So, you know, the Chinese students make up an incredible proportion of the full fee-paying students in our high school system.
Now, coming back to the tertiary students, can you give us some of the best practice examples of how the universities are supporting both their onshore and offshore Chinese students?
For those who are onshore, we've had many wonderful examples of universities who've provided care packages to students who, again, have been in the quarantine 14-day period. They've reached out to many of their Chinese students to ensure that their mental health is being taken care of, because, of course, we have to factor in that those that did not go back for Lunar New Year and those continuing Chinese students that stayed in Australia, in some cases they've got boyfriends, girlfriends, they've got personal situations which are quite stressful. They may have entered into a lease agreement in the private rental market in Australia and their flatmate can't return, so who pays the rent? So quite a number of stressful situations have been encountered, and in most cases the universities have been able to look at a student-by-student approach and try and ensure that their students understand, who are still onshore here in Australia, that their welfare is paramount. When it comes to offshore, what we've had by way of best practice examples have included some really good online learning options. Now, we heard today that ANU, the first institution I'm aware of to offer free online tuition for any of their courses for their commencing students and looking after some of their continuing students. I guess the dilemma here is that obviously you can't provide special dispensation or special benefits to one cohort over another, so you have to be careful there that if you're trying to attract commencing students, you don't thereby get your continuing students offside if they feel as though they're still being charged for a product. So that's going to be an interesting one for universities to sort out. But online learning is being provided by quite a number of our universities now. Once they can get over their learning management systems and make sure that either their own learning management systems can be utilised for teaching into China, or they may have to contract with some of the platforms such as Canvas, I understand, Cloud Campus, Moodle. There's a number of third-party providers that have got mirror servers in Beijing or have the ability to teach into China. In all of that, of course, the Chinese government do not agree to have YouTube or live streaming happening, and given the way that we teach in Australia, obviously that's an impediment that many institutions are having to find a way around in terms of their teaching practices. So online learning has definitely become a viable option, notwithstanding concerns that we had a week or so ago about the Chinese government not being supportive of online learning. The next challenge, though, in that particular arena is going to be to get Chinese government approval down the track for any units of study that have been taught exclusively online. Because what many of your listeners would not probably realise is that any offshore qualification has to be signed off by the Chinese Ministry of Education in order for the Chinese student, when they go home, to get the official certification from their own government that would help them in the job market. And this is a challenge in itself at the best of times with some courses, and now we have this conundrum of, well, will the Ministry of Education agree to compromise on what in the past has been fairly rigid rules around academic credit for online learning?
So what do you see as the key lessons for the sector out of this crisis? Have Australian universities become too dependent on foreign students and especially the Chinese market?
At the end of the day, China is the most heavily populated country in the world. It's on our regional doorstep, and it has an incredible appetite for having their children study offshore. For Australia, that has been able to provide a wonderful coming together of both an economic benefit, but also the ability to teach Western values of critical thinking, creative learning to a cohort of students who wouldn't necessarily be exposed to that type of pedagogy. So we can never overlook the incredible soft power, soft diplomacy benefits that have derived for our Western democracy by teaching not just Chinese but so many other young future leaders from our Asian neighbouring countries. Having said that, every university has been aware for some time that they need to diversify their markets. The challenges they face is that Latin America, we now have Colombia and Brazil very much in our top 10 student source countries. In fact, Brazil is now number 5 for Australia as a whole. But you find that the Latin Americans tend to come to Australia and study English language or hospitality vocational diplomas, and they don't have the wherewithal often to then pay for higher education in Australia, or they can go back to their bankrupt economies, in many cases in Latin America, and still get free higher education tuition. So we're not getting the higher education flow on from Latin American markets. In equal measure, the Indian market is incredibly, it's a wonderful market, but it's incredibly price sensitive and also migration focused. And we've just had Boris Johnson in the UK reinstate, after 7 years of Theresa May really putting up barriers to entry for particularly subcontinent students into the UK, Boris Johnson has now reintroduced post-study work-right visas where you can do a one-year master's program in the UK at any university there and qualify for 2 years full-time work entitlement after you graduate from a one-year master's program. Now, in Australia, we also provide two-year post-study work-right visas. In fact, we introduced them when Theresa May, as Home Secretary, abolished them in the UK 7 years ago. But you have to do a two-year master's to qualify. So already we've had what they call a media tsunami out of India, particularly in the Punjab, where families are saying, no, we're going to send our child to the UK, to the original sort of colonial power country, and it's going to be cheaper because we get a one-year master's program and our child will be able to stay in the UK economy. So with potential entry into Europe, whatever. So we've already got market disruption happening in other student source countries. So China is very much still the country which we look to when it comes to a supply of high-quality students who have got an incredible appetite for highly ranked universities, which happily our universities are, relative to other systems in other countries, very highly ranked. And that appetite is, well, it remains there. It would be foolish to overlook it. However, the key point is that you can't rely in any business on one market overly without at least banking some of your funds and for a rainy day and looking to other markets, even to cross-subsidise if required.
Well, given the large slice of the market that the Chinese students occupy, will this disruption mean that universities have to tighten their belts?
Obviously, whichever party, political party, has been in government in Australia, there's almost been a devil's compact, and I think this has been identified by Peter Varghese, the current Chancellor of the University of Queensland, where successive Australian governments have thought, well, we don't need to necessarily fund our universities at a level that would be desirable because so many of them are able to cross-subsidise their activities, particularly their research activities that maintain their high rankings through overseas full fee paying tuition. And we all know, go to any university campus in Australia and you'll see many of the brand new significant buildings have come off the back of international student tuition fees, not from government largesse, so to speak. So I think it's a wake-up call for every political party in Australia to think, well, hang on, do we need to start to factor in sufficient funding if international student revenue is going to decline over the longer term? And in equal measure, our universities themselves have to think, well, if we're going to rely on one country for substantial revenue in the future, then to what extent are we overcommitting ourselves to massive building programs and overcommitting ourselves to certain activities that are high cost and obviously may not be sustainable?
Just on the question of reputational harm, especially since the Chinese authorities have been critical of Australia's move to close its border, will that make recruitment of students from China more difficult in the future after this particular incident passes?
We have to do much better with our Department of Home Affairs in terms of consistent messaging and policy implementation. We have had, no doubt, some unfortunate situations with our border force, which have been involved inconsistent decision-making. Some students have been put back on planes back to China while others were allowed to self-quarantine and stay in Australia. And that was a very unfortunate situation in that 1st of February hiatus period when many students were in transit into Australia. In equal measure, our Home Affairs Department also need to put out some much better and clearer FAQ sheets so that people can actually get meaningful information with clarity around what can and can't be done. So, for example, it is possible for Chinese students to go to a third country, be it Thailand or be it Malaysia currently, and provided they can prove they've been in that country for a minimum of 14 days, they are allowed entry into Australia. Now, what we have to make sure is that our border force are fully aware and appraised of that rule, because we don't want to have another situation along the lines of February 1 where you have students being turned away at the border even though they've met that 14-day self-quarantine period in a third country. So the task force I'm chairing is meeting tomorrow, and one of the key issues that we will be directing, if possible, for Home Affairs to comply with is just clear, consistent information, particularly around border force jurisdiction and border force rulings when it comes to the student's right of entry.
And do you think the Minister, Peter Dutton, is aware of these problems and acting to try and fix them?
The Minister in charge, though, is Acting Minister for Immigration, Alan Tudge. To his credit, when our task force raised the issue that in China the Home Affairs Department were processing future student visas for Chinese students who want to come to Australia, but they weren't approving them, we were able to get Minister Tudge, to, with Minister Tien's support, to get a ruling from the Cabinet that student visas could be approved rather than just sitting in the queue in China, though to be approved forthwith from last Friday. So we've already had some glimmer of hope that the Minister in charge of student visas, Alan Tudge, is willing to assist when we take to him bona fide issues of concern. But we're still a long way short of getting some clarity around some of the Home Affairs issues that need to be better understood.
Philip Honeywood, thank you very much for talking with The Conversation today.
Thank you, Michelle.
And that's all for today's podcast. Thank you to my producer, Tom Glassie. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.